John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you'll thank us after this hour is over. Where do we stand Armageddon-wise these days? Not Hunger Games, dystopian, pop culture, every other movie is about the end of the world-wise. By the measure of action movies in Hollywood, we're already well past DEFCON 5 and picking up the plutonium rapture's rubble. It's not just Hollywood. Movie storylines in every language for much of this century have been driven by mushroom cloud special effects or fear of nukes.
Godzilla, king of the monsters. Is this the end of our civilization?
Meanwhile, out here in this Cold War is over, no more nukes enlightened real world, where peace and cooperation are supposedly breaking out all over, outside of the reliable terrorists with old-fashioned explosives, some video cameras, and an internet address. These are the weapons of the 21st century. Here in the real world, where are the real nukes? Maybe Ukraine or Crimea, annexed by Russia last year. We learned this week that Russia's foreign ministry believes that Moscow can go ahead and put nuclear weapons in Crimea. Lovely. Aimed at Black Sea coal barges, cruise ships, Latvia, Berlin. In Washington, the U.S. has been quietly upgrading its nuclear arsenal, although it couldn't prevent the Oak Ridge nuclear facility in Tennessee from being breached by three people, including a nun, in July of 2012. And last year, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says he wants the morale of U.S. nuclear forces to be upgraded along with the warheads. There's bad morale right now, he says.
The root cause has been a lack of sustained focus, attention, and resources, resulting in a pervasive sense that a career in the nuclear enterprise offers too few opportunities for growth and advancement.
We want good morale in the U.S. nuclear forces? Now that's a little unsettling.
America has around 4,800 nuclear warheads, which is more than enough, not just to destroy Earth, but to provide 4th of July fireworks for Martians.
Thank you, John Oliver. So, here's the count. We've got 4,800 happy U.S. warheads here at home. The Economist estimates that irrelevant France has 300 warheads. Very relevant Russia has 4,300. Pakistan, that nation of great morale, has the fastest-growing program with some 120 warheads and counting. India, 110. Well, if Pakistan, then India, right? Actually, India was first. The U.K. comes in at 225. I guess the Brits have to have some because of John Oliver, right? China, of course, they're at 250. North Korea may have as many as 10, which is like China having 10,000. And Israel, home of the Bible, the original screenplay about the rapture, they have 80. Cue the angels, please. So, on the 30th anniversary of Mikhail Gorbachev coming to power, remember him, end of the Cold War, treaty signing Gorby, as the United States and some others try to talk Iran out of joining this nuclear club under a deadline at the end of March, talks which the Republicans in the U.S. Senate want to scuttle, by the way, let's see where we stand. Paul Bracken, professor of management and political science at Yale University, welcome to The Takeaway. Is this the surprising, terrifying Act Two of the nuclear age?
I think that's exactly what it is. It's very easy to get lost in the day-to-day politics of the Iran so-called agreement, or even worse, the Israeli politics. But what's happening is much more important, and that is you're seeing the appearance of what I call a second nuclear age. The first nuclear age was the Cold War. This time we're seeing more and more countries get the bomb, and they're going to be starting to use it in a lot of ways like the Cold War, but undoubtedly in some new ways as well.
Is there no mutual assured destruction in, say, South Asia, where India and Pakistan both have a bomb?
I don't think there is a mutual assured destruction other than between the U.S. and Russia today. The big problem is in the regions. That is to say, the latest estimates suggest North Korea is going for 100 nuclear warheads. The fastest growing nuclear power in the world today is Pakistan, which is building a lot of small ones. But they're still quite small by Cold War standards. And this is very destabilizing because it's not implausible to write a scenario where you could take out the weapons of the other side with a first strike. now combining modern conventional weapons like stealth and precision strike, not just with a nuclear attack. So it's really getting to be more dangerous than it's been for many decades.
And just to focus on the takeaway there, smaller is more dangerous.
Smaller arsenal sizes, yeah, number of nuclear bombs, that's basically it. When you had thousands, as the superpowers did in the Cold War, you couldn't write any scenario where you could get them all. But when you're dealing with North Korea, where there's only 20, Israel probably has about 80 to 100. These are attacks that are not that much more complex than the attack on Pearl Harbor.
What about the, and I referred earlier this hour to the irrelevance of France. Does the fact that France has some 300 warheads constitute a destabilizing phenomenon in the world if the French take their eye off the ball here?
France is an interesting case, and so is Britain. I don't think they're destabilizing. What's interesting about the European forces, the French and the British, is that after the United States declared we were going to rid the world of nuclear weapons and President Obama received a Nobel Prize, we put no pressure whatsoever on France and Britain to get rid of their nuclear forces. And what does this show? This shows us that nuclear weapons still have great value. There's a lot of politics involved in these things. We don't want to be the only democracy with nuclear weapons. And it allows France and Britain, interestingly enough, to punch above their weight in international affairs. They are basically decimating their conventional military forces. So all they have left is a bunch of special operations people and some nuclear weapons.
Oh, that's terrifying. So in a sense, once Obama got his Nobel Prize, it would have been an easy one to get Britain and France out of the nuclear game. But for political reasons, we chose not to. And now here we are.
That's the takeaway. You could see why it would be hard to talk North Korea, Pakistan, Iran out of their bombs for obvious reasons. But how can you write – I cannot write a scenario where France or Britain uses nuclear weapons outside of the United States. And yet we put no pressure on them, indicating the sort of deep point I want to make here is that we're seeing a new geopolitical era emerge right before our eyes, which is a multipolar nuclear world. You've got 9 nuclear weapon states, probably soon going to be 10 with Iran. And of the 9 that we have today, 8 of them are modernizing their forces, their nuclear forces, for 21st century conditions.
So then here's the big question. You've got the leftover Cold War nukes, that's the U.S. and Russia. You've got the regional sort of punching above their weight nuclear powers like North Korea in the worst case scenario and France and Britain in the sort of best case scenario. And then you've got regional concerns in South Asia with India and Pakistan. China, arguably the superpower of the 21st century, a nuclear power. What are they to take from all of this in their strategic kind of design here?
Well, one of the things they're going to take away is not to disarm the way the United States has been urging countries to do in the 2009 President Obama speech. They'd have to be out of their skulls to do that. They're modernizing at hell-bent speed their nuclear forces. And the interesting thing, I think, is that very soon the Chinese nuclear force is going to impact the U.S.-Russian nuclear balance. What do I mean? I mean that if you add parts of the Chinese force to the Russian force, it looks a lot more dangerous to us. Now, I will point out that all of the arms control that the United States has advanced for the past 20 years is built on a Cold War model, 2 powers. We don't include China in these calculations. We're going to have to do that.
We played a clip of Chuck Hagel on his way out as Secretary of Defense talking about how it was a real mistake in the Pentagon and in the U.S. military to give people in the nuclear force the impression that it was a dead end and that he was spending billions of dollars on modernizing the nuclear arsenal and in giving the impression that there's going to be great morale among the nuclear forces going forward. That, in light of what you're saying, is kind of terrifying, a hell-bent nuclear force in the United States in the 21st century.
Well, it's not hell-bent yet. What's been happening is that the nuclear forces have been ignored to the point where most of the studies show they don't even know how to move these things around safely. What the studies further show is that the reason for that is they've been getting ignored by senior leadership at the top. If you want to make your way in this man's Air Force, you really don't want to go into the nuclear forces. People talk about modernization. Most of the money allocated for modernization in the U.S. has not been spent. It's been allocated, but been put into the Iraq War, the Afghan War, et cetera, et cetera. So, and the other point I want to make is when we talk about modernization, that term isn't really allowed to be used in the Pentagon. What they're talking about is life extension and governance of the arsenal, because they don't want to create the impression that we are building new nuclear forces. I can predict right now we will build new nuclear forces in the next few years, given the trends that are going on in Russia, China, and North Korea, et cetera.
Will we spend any money on the security for those forces to keep them safe?
Well, I certainly hope so. When you have an 85-year-old nun break into a nuclear weapons complex in Tennessee, and the answer that the security people from the outsourced company that had the contract for security, they didn't even do it themselves, they said the cameras were broken, so we didn't know they were entering it. And they thought that that was an acceptable answer. Yeah, I hope we spend more on security.
Paul Bracken, professor of management and political science at Yale University. Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
In the same week, Apple rolls out a watch that you can send your best friends your heart rate and blood pressure data while you're still in the middle of your morning run. Hillary Clinton was trying to catch the world up on the forensics of her delete key.
I saw it as a matter of convenience, and it was allowed. Others had done it.
That's from her news conference yesterday to address the issue of deleted emails while she was Secretary of State. And this is all very convenient to the Twitter sphere, which loves this sort of thing. Fox News host Todd Starnes tweeted, "This is what an imploding presidential campaign looks like. Hashtag Hillary." TV's House of Cards fictional Francis Underwood got involved. Advice for at Hillary Clinton, he tweeted, "Keep a phone for work and one for play. It's really not that difficult." And you might say the inventors of snarky Twitter-like headlines, the New York Post, ran this on the front page, "Deleter of the free world."
I think there's this way in which the culture almost wills these moments into significance.
That's author Jacob Silverman, contributor to Slate and The Atlantic, whose new book, Terms of Service, Social Media and the Price of Constant Connection, says the parallel universe of social media is having a growing impact on culture. The digital trail left by Hillary Clinton that is now a campaign issue, Silverman says, is an issue in some sense for everyone.
One thing that really interests me is what I call the culture of surveillance, about how watching one another and placing ourselves to be watched by other people is really becoming an accepted way of how we form our identities, how we communicate with other people, this notion that we're all public figures in one sort or another now. And I think that is definitely a big change versus how things might have been, say, 10 years ago.
You know, in academia, they always talk about publish or perish, that somehow you don't have an identity unless you're published. You haven't achieved seventh grade if you're not on Instagram.
Yeah, I think that's actually very apt. The way in which a lot of our social media environments are constructed, the way these platforms work, is that you have to put in some time and effort to maintain visibility. You have to publish or else you perish. So if you're not posting regularly on whether it's Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or wherever else, you kind of slip out of view. You're no longer in the news feed. There are no longer updates about you. Your identity kind of feels less than finished, perhaps, because you're not producing new material.
Is there a neutral position here? Can you be obsessively online all the time or not at all? And is that viewed as normal, or is it somehow extraordinarily abnormal to be invisible and absent?
The trend is certainly that invisibility is a strange kind of absence and abnormal almost. Someone told me this before they were going on a date, I think, that they Googled someone and the person didn't have much of a presence on the internet, it seemed like, and that was almost a red flag. And now I don't think everyone necessarily shares these opinions, but I think it's sort of understandable why someone might think that way too, because we've become habituated towards this notion that everyone sort of has a shingle that they hang online, if not quite a few, and that they maintain.
Aside from the cultural sort of parallel universe that's created by all of these social networking sites, what alarms you most about this burgeoning phenomenon?
What worries me in particular in the privacy conversation is what I sort of distinguish between two different types. There's the type of privacy in which you want to control what other people know about you. So say you're a gay kid and you haven't come out yet to your family and you live in an area where there's a fair amount of homophobia or something like that. You might worry that information you post on Facebook that you want only a small audience to see might suddenly be exposed to other people. But then there's also a different type of privacy, I think, which is less examined, which I just refer to simply as data privacy. The data that is created surrounding all of our behaviors and activities online, and it's kind of used against us in ways we don't expect.
How do the algorithms in social media customize themselves to our behavior and try to elicit more information from us? Algorithms that try to make us feel like there's some friendly character there behind the screen.
Sure. Well, I think there are a couple of different ways. I mean, the one thing you can say in general is that we have very little idea of how a lot of algorithms are involved in filtering and eliciting information from us actually work. So on Facebook, we know that the average person has over 1,000 pieces of information appearing in their Facebook news feed at any given time or that could appear there. But Facebook doesn't want you to feel overwhelmed by everything that's being posted by everyone you follow and like and are friends with. So they're filtering it based on specific criteria that they're not really sharing with you. And we also saw, as some stories revealed over the summer, that Facebook also is in the business of testing different responses from their users. So perhaps if they think that certain information will make you feel happier or more likely to stay on the platform, which is really the main goal, is to stay on the platform for as long as possible and keep you happy and clicking, perhaps they'll start filtering out more negative news because they think you need more positive news.
How do you evaluate the "what color is this dress" moment?
Well, I think it was just sort of a lot of things landing at the right time, perhaps.
That's what all these are. This viralness is all kind of little perfect storms.
Right, right. And I think there's also a genuine sense in which people want that perfect storm. You know, to me, there wasn't anything necessarily about that particular phenomenon. The people who are online and connected and plugged into this kind of thing, there is this almost shared sense that we want this to be an obsession. We want this to be what everyone's fixating on all of a sudden. I mean, we used to get this kind of feeling when a disaster happened and all the TV news channels cut in, say, sorry to interrupt regular programming, there's been an accident or something like that. But now you can kind of have that collective feeling of shared attention, of shared value, that something is really important, matters quite a bit, about things that might be interesting but are also frequently meaningless.
Jacob Silverman is the author of Terms of Service, Social Media, and the Price of Constant Connection. Jacob, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Contribution from Morristown, New Jersey. Everyone has their own personal threshold for what they're comfortable sharing, but I would say if you panic and delete it within 5 to 10 minutes or the morning after a night of heavy drinking, you probably overshared.
This is Barbara from Monterey, Massachusetts. As long as I'm okay with it showing up on the front page of the local newspaper or even the New York Times, well, it's okay to post it to social media. Otherwise, I'd rather not plaster it all over.
Barbara, maybe you should join Hillary Clinton's campaign. From Hickory, North Carolina, nothing more than the NSA already has. Would that person be willing to share? That's true no matter what your privacy settings are. Join the conversation. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. TIAA-CREF. A financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
So there's a shooting war against ISIS going on right now, Iraq versus ISIS, with the U.S. bringing up the rear. You're going to hear the sound of it in a moment. So why is President Obama's proposed authorized for the use of military force memorandum to take on ISIS maybe in trouble on Capitol Hill? Secretary of State John Kerry, Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chair General Martin Dempsey testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. The problem, once again, Democrats worry about vagueness. while Republicans worry it's not tough enough. Add to that, some of the same senators who want to disrupt the Iranian nuclear negotiations believe this operation, currently trying to push ISIS out of the Iraqi city of Tikrit with a retrained, reconstituted Iraqi army, is actually only going to benefit Iran. Joining me now, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Hey, Todd.
Hi, John.
So what's the headline out of this hearing here as you see it?
Well, John, here on Capitol Hill, the headline is pretty easy. The AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force, is having a hard time finding the votes. It hasn't come up for a vote yet, but you can see the skepticism from all across Republicans and Democrats in the Foreign Relations Committee, Democrats in particular. And a lot of this isn't so new, but these positions are hardening. Democrats are extremely skeptical of a number of things, John. One, the definition of this term that floats around Washington from the White House now, no enduring offensive operations, no enduring offensive forces will be used, i.e. boots on the ground. What does that language mean? Does that mean 2 years, 3 years? The administration, John Kerry and Ashton Carter, say that means no war like Iraq and Afghanistan. That's what that means. But Democrats, John, are extremely skeptical about the rest of that definition and what they'd be signing on to. They're also skeptical about the authorization the president gets to fight associated forces with ISIL. A couple of them pointed out, hey, Boko Haram in Nigeria just pledged allegiance to ISIL. Does that mean we could bomb Nigeria if they're associated forces? They think that language is too weak, too. And here's the third thing. It's on how long this authorization lasts. It lasts for 3 years, but nobody thinks the war against ISIS will be over that quickly. Listen to Ashton Carter, the defense secretary.
The president's proposed authorization affords the American people the chance to assess our progress in 3 years' time and provides the next president and the next Congress the opportunity to reauthorize it if they find it necessary. To me, this is a sensible and principled provision of the AUMF, even though I cannot assure that the counter-ISIL campaign will be completed in 3 years.
When Ashton Carter isn't there and Obama isn't there and John Kerry isn't there, but these senators probably will be there. So there you go.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they view any vote on ISIL, and probably rightfully so, as what's called a legacy vote. Everybody remembers how they voted on the war against Iraq and Afghanistan, and they view this one the same way, John.
What about Iran?
Well, there are a lot of concerns, of course. Look, we've been talking a lot this week about concerns over nuclear negotiations with Iran. A lot of Republicans, of course, 47 of them, signed that letter that has become so very controversial to the government of Iran. But here's the main concern in the short term, and you heard a lot of this coming out in the hearing. The offensive that is coming up into Crete, there are some 20 to 30,000 troops, maybe more, getting ready to drive ISIS out of Saddam Hussein's hometown into Crete. And that, according to administration officials, including General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is going to prove a lot about Iran's intentions fighting essentially on our side. There are 20,000 Shia militia trained and equipped by Iran, 1,000 Iranian personnel, advisors and intel officers getting ready to fight this battle. People are worried about reprisals, about revenge, what will happen after ISIL is kicked out. Listen to Dempsey.
Believe me, I share your concerns, and we're watching carefully. The Tikrit operation will be a strategic inflection point one way or the other in terms of easing our concerns or increasing them.
Inflection point? It could be mission accomplished for the mullahs in Iran.
Well, that's one of the fears. Look, again, let's go over these numbers because they're huge. 20,000 Shia militia armed and trained by Iran with 1,000 Iranian personnel in this operation. We want ISIL out of Tikrit, and Dempsey says he's confident that will happen. What happens afterward? Will Sunnis be allowed to return to their homes, or will Shia militia and their proxies and Iran's proxies be unleashed to exact reprisals? There's a lot of concern about that.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. We'll leave it there. Thanks, Todd.
You bet, John.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com.
The hills are alive with the sound of music.
The unforgettable sound of Rodgers and Hammerstein, telling the story of that family that stayed together during World War II, the Von Trapps, a family that's still playing together.
Love doesn't make our lives easier at all. It can only make it worth the time.
Sophia, Melanie, Amanda, and August von Trapp singing about love in a slightly perceptible Austrian accent, Austria by way of Vermont, Montana, and Portland, Oregon. These von Trapps are the direct descendants of the original von Trapps, and they need no Rodgers and Hammerstein to tell their generation's story. But it helps.
Our grandfather was portrayed as Kurt in the Sound of Music, and our great-grandparents were the Captain Maria von Trapp, and Kurt's youngest son is our father.
And how did you get from Salzburg to Portland, Oregon?
So the von Trapps settled in Vermont after they were done touring and after they escaped Austria. They settled in Vermont, and that's pretty much where the whole family lived today. But our dad decided to take a motorcycle trip around the U.S. and fell in love with Montana, and so decided to raise us there. But then about 2 years ago, we moved here to Portland, Oregon.
You know, there's a lot of mythology around your family, and I'm sure a lot of it annoys you, but it sounds to me like there was a little movie Maria in your motorcycle dad.
Whoa. Wow. I don't think anyone said that before.
I didn't ever make that connection before.
That's funny. Well, we, like, the Von Trapps like mountains, so the Vermont mountains were just not quite enough, so we had to go for Montana.
The Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Rockies are the varsity. Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. That is true. Naturally.
And I gather you didn't need any, you know, governess, whatever, nursemaid, Maria, grandmother telling you to sing. You guys were musical from the beginning.
Actually, people have asked us if it's sort of an expected thing for the Von Trapps to continue singing, but
our parents can't sing.
Yeah, our parents can't sing. But yeah, it's just something we kind of grew up with doing for fun until it turned into something. You know, well, our grandfather actually, he had a stroke in 2001, and that's why we recorded the songs that he had taught us growing up, and that was sort of how we, you know, started in any kind of career with music. We made an album, and that was like 14 years ago. So, yeah.
Wow. So, give me a song of yours that is about as far from anything Von Trappy or Sound of Music-y as you can imagine, and then we'll think about one that's actually close to maybe some of that music that would be more familiar to people. What's the farthest away from what people might associate with the Von Trapps?
Well,
probably this new project that we're doing.
Yeah, we have one song on the album called Whisper that ends up getting pretty almost rock feeling at the end. Yeah, that's probably the furthest departure we have from the, you know, SOM kind of repertoire.
So if I can just guess for a second, it seems to me that you have an optimistic Von Trapp tradition that you sort of carry with you on some level. But there's also, if you're a millennial, you know, of your age, there's that kind of dark introspection thing in the music of your era. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, actually, that's interesting. Kind of nails it. It is introspective, but at the same time, I do feel like we try to pump in as much of an optimistic, like hopeful spirit to everything that we do. I think something that's so beautiful about the legacy of the Sound of Music and the film itself, and why people constantly respond to it, even, you know, generations later, is that it's so relevant. There's a hope that just kind of lifts you up and helps you get through darker times. And I don't think any of us want to give that up as part of our history, because we've seen and met so many people all over the world, from, you know, a tiny village in Africa to, you know, South Korea to Japan to Australia, where people still really appreciate that story.
And what do you think? What did you think of Gaga at the Oscars?
That was amazing.
Pretty amazing. It was definitely a shock. We were at dinner, and all of a sudden their Twitter starts blasting and says, "Oh, Lady Gaga is saying Sound of Music," and we went and listened to it. It is impressive.
My heart wants to sing.
heard she worked for every day for 6 months to get that performance down, and it was. I was nice that it was so kept so
so understated,
traditional,
yeah,
and really understated, yeah, beautiful. Absolutely, a great job.
So you know, reach out, get a call back.
Yeah, yeah. We tried.
Any Lederhosen folks in the audience at your concerts coming up to you still?
Oh yeah, there's a guy in Oakland actually. We sing this song "Die Dorfmusik," which is like a German folk song, and there's some yodeling in it, so we dedicated it to the guy.
Oh yeah,
with the Lederhosen.
You guys are so well adjusted, because that would just completely creep me out—a guy from Oakland and Lederhosen.
Oh man,
well, there is a fine line. We've learned to laugh at a lot and also try to, you know, exit the elevator quicker than we used to.
Sounds like a scene from Sound of Music. Exit the elevator quickly. Yeah,
that's right.
So you want to take us out? Do a song?
Absolutely, sure. Yes.
So tell us what we're going to hear.
This is a song on the new EP called Next to Me.
And the EP is called Dancing in Gold, and it comes out on April 14th.
All right, take it away.
Now that the winter is gone and the spring has moved on, we are left in summertime. My dear, you know I have one fear. It's that I will not change, that I will stay the same. But you're next to me.
Von Trapps, Sophia, Melanie, Amanda, and August will be hitting the road on March 28th for a national tour and releasing their first album of original songs, Dancing in Gold, on April 14th.
Then all that can keep us down with your push and your pull, I won't feel my own.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.